Welcome to episode 24 of Old Stories, New Information. I'm your host, Brent Colley. And on today's episode, I will share with you one of my favorite historical finds, 2008. I'm exploring what I refer to as the catch-all closet at the Sharon Historical Society. And wedged under one of the metal storage units is a box just labeled Rhodes. And that turned out to be a fascinating collection of papers, sketches, articles, and notes on early roadways in northwestern Connecticut and the New York border towns. So it was similar to the boxes that I've created myself, so largely out of respect for the gentleman, I decided to make it a project and go through it thoroughly over the next couple weeks, and I'm really glad that I did. Overall, the box was a treasure trove. Information that I just couldn't imagine. You know, the guy probably spent years making this box or making the information that's in the box. But the most intriguing find was this handwritten account of the survey that Robert Livingston took of his manor boundaries between New York State and Connecticut. The first source, the primary source, noted that Livingston, aided by three Native American Indian guides, came up through our area. He basically followed the pathways that are now known as our roads, South Amenia Road, Amenia Union, and Route 41. So now I'm hooked because that's right in my neighborhood. And I needed to know more about Indian pathways and guides and whether or not this was a common thing or was Livingston just, you know, one rare case. So I started making calls to my historian friends, and eventually one of them says, "Haven't you seen the map?" Well, obviously I had no knowledge of the map, but I did find it, and now you can too. It's easy. Google search Yukon and magic, and the first result will be the University of Connecticut's Maps and Geographic Information Center, a.k.a. MAGIC. And under maps, historical map collections, and Connecticut, including county maps, that's the important part, you'll find a map of the state of Connecticut showing Indian trails, villages, and sachemdoms. So it's the most amazing map I've ever seen. It shows Connecticut as it was in 1625. It's just awesome. So my next search was who made it, and what information did he use to do it? Well, it turns out it's two men. So they're both from Manchester, Connecticut, and the individual who makes it, his name is Hayden Griswold. He made the map in 1930 based on the information of a gentleman named Mathis Spies. So Griswold would go on to have his own engineering firm. But early on, he worked with Cheney Brothers. And Cheney Brothers, if you haven't seen it, was a really neat factory in Manchester. They produce silk. So there's a museum there that shows that. So that was a cool connection for me as a historian. But you know, Spies was really intriguing. He was like most historians. He was a tobacco broker. And then when he retired, he devoted his energies to being a historian. So he not only did the history of the town of Manchester, but he was a well-known writer of the history of Indian tribes in Connecticut, did a lot of research on that. And he actually was published in the Connecticut Tercentenary Commission's monograph. That's how important he was. And he was just really a civic-minded kind of guy. He was a selectman for the town. And he was the police commissioner for Manchester as well. So a really neat individual. And the great thing about the Yukon map collection is that you can download the maps in multiple sizes, and you can print them. And that's what really led me to my next discovery. For those of us over the age of 40, we still remember paper maps. That was there were no GPS screens in the car dashboard. There were no phones with Waze apps on them. There were print versions of either the Rand McNally map or my dad's personal favorite, Hagstrom. And travel routes were often highlighted and starred, and the person in the passenger seat pretty much doubled as a control station for the trip. So I took one of these paper maps of Connecticut, and I laid it on the floor. And standing over it with my printed 1625 map in hand, what I saw was really astonishing. The Native American pathways and settlements all matched up perfectly with our present-day towns, highways, and railways. So I saw all of the highways that I'm aware of now. I saw 7, Route 7, 41, 44, 84, 95, the Berlin Turnpike. Every single major road and railway and every town and city matched up with the map of the Indian villages and pathways. So that led me on my next quest, and that was to better understand the Native American or indigenous people's use of land and their travel, and then what occurred when the Europeans arrived. So that gets into to the European arrival. The Dutch, as many of us know, arrived in Hartford area via the Connecticut River around 1610. So they're there for at least two decades. And up in Boston in 1631, the Podunk sachem makes a visit to them to invite the colonists there to consider settling in the Hartford area. We basically think that trade with the Dutch was probably getting less desirable, and so the Podunks and others wanted a little competition, if you will, between the Europeans. So to get to Boston, he travels several pathways, and it takes his group 5 days on foot to get to Boston. If you look at the routes in the present day, you're basically looking at 384, 44, 197, and 198. So the English would take a look at Connecticut and decide to come, and Roger Ludlow, and we've all heard the story of the Reverend Thomas Hooker being the most notable, and their settlements. So within 8 years of the ask of the Podunk sachem, we're here. Unfortunately, that didn't work out very well as the Pequot War breaks out, and then the English start to spread all along the coastal areas of Connecticut that are along Long Island Sound. So this is 1639, 1640. So now the English settlements are along the coastal areas of the Sound, and really from 1639 to 1651, there's no English settlements that are kind of in the interior of western Connecticut. And that, so if you think about it, that's a decent time period between their arrival on the coast and moving in. And it's Derby who settles initially in 1651, and it's really the Indian trails and a ford. A ford is a low point in a river that you can pass by foot. It's not deep, you know, it's not like waist deep. It's just kind of foot and ankle kind of deep. That's what's referred to as a ford, and that's where Naugatuck meets the Housatonic. Next from there, you'll see Woodbury come into play, and that's in 1672. Again, Indian trails are leading these people to the interior. And then finally, you know, from Norwalk to Danbury, Danbury is established in 1684. Same thing. So this really kind of intrigued me to understand, you know, why the Indian pathways were important and what happened next. And the other thing, too, tying back to Livingston, was, like, why do we need guides? Well, you know, we all walk, or most of us up here walk on pathways, Appalachian Trail, if you will, or any of the land trusts trails, and you can see like clearly the path ahead of you, obviously because it's been well walked over the course of time. But there are certain Indian paths that were not as easy to find as you would think. Think like, you know, an animal trail or something along those lines. And in looking into, you know, what was going on at that moment in time, one writer notes that the English sadly search up and down for a known way, the Indian pass being only about one foot road. So they may travel for many days and never find one. So, and but that just proved to me that, that I understand that. They needed the guides of the Native Americans to learn where these pathways were and also where they went. Obviously, the use of guides would continue. Think about the Lewis and Clark expedition, for example. So what's really neat is that from these small pathways, we start to build into the progression of a transportation system for us here in Connecticut. So the simplest roads, the early ones, were described as paths cut out, which means that the brush was cut along the pathway, and then the trees were probably marked with an axe. The next is making these pathways passable for horses. And they did that by cutting the limbs higher to permit the passage of a horse and a rider. So for many years, this was the method that we used throughout the state to move from one area to the other. And then pack horses become very common, and goods were often transported by the pack horse trains. The next one is really the most important one. So this would prove to be what really changes and makes towns in the interior more feasible. And this was widening the bridle paths to accommodate ox carts. So oxen were strong and very capable of travel over terrain that would be pretty much impassable by a horse-drawn cart. And the carts are just about the width of the back end of the oxen. So in clearing and widening these roads, it really made a big difference in Connecticut's move to the interior, but also trading and improving our economies. Believe it or not, pack horse lobbyists were protesting this because, now they're going to be going out of business. So they were claiming that it was a waste of taxpayers' money. And unfortunately, for them, they lost. But as for the state, the inland settlements just kind of explode soon after that decision. So it's a kind of a neat look at how we came to be. So I look at all the different towns, through this Indian map, and you basically have pioneer settlements, and then you have those that result from the success of the improvement of these pioneer settlements. So you're looking at, like I said, Derby, Woodbury, Southbury, Danbury, obviously New Haven, and it would just continue from there. And all over the state, you see how these pathways impacted the improvements to Connecticut itself. Even the postal routes, so even the post office relied on these converted Indian pathways to make them easier for, obviously, the post rider to make their way across Connecticut, both north and south and east and west. And what's really prominent in the Indian map, if you are to pull up that 1625 map, is the postal route. So that's Route 1 along the coast, which is, now it looks just like Route 1 or 95. And then what we kind of the upper post road was the US 5 and US 20. I think most of us know it as the Berlin Turnpike that goes from New Haven all the way up to Springfield. And then 44 was basically what they referred to as the middle post roads. So it's really interesting to think about that transition and what it meant to us. So, in terms of the early postal system and the purpose, it greatly improved the first mail is like 1717, and from Boston to Virginia, it was like a month in the summer and 2 months in the winter. And then when you add in Philadelphia, the timeline starts to be reduced. But by the time Ben Franklin gets involved in 1750s, I think the 1754 was it, he's reduced the trip from New York to Philly from 3 days to like a day and a half. So you can see the great improvements. But what's neat about us in the present day is that we can still see remnants of those postal routes in, if you're lucky enough to find them, the stones that you can see that mark the distance between the places. So when Franklin gets involved, he or someone with him comes up with a way to record mileage, and then mileage stones get put in, so that individual, whether you're delivering mail or now you're getting into turnpikes and stagecoaches, people know how far they are from one location to the other. And how they did this was that they kind of made a really early version of an odometer. So when the wheels of the vehicle that was recording the mileage turned 400 times, that was a mile, and they wrote it down, and then eventually it would go on to a stone and tell the individual where it is. I think the most prominent one up here in the northwest corner is at the very top of the New Milford Green, and that marks the Albany Turnpike. So that went from Hartford through New Milford and obviously on to Albany, you know, where I grew up in the Reading area. There was still a milestone marker that notes 12 miles from Norwalk or Danbury. So that was the halfway point between the two locations. And it also noted where the tavern was, because the halfway point is where they changed horses, but also, you know, taverns, because they were places of sharing information, were basically early post office. So it's really interesting. So now we get into not only roadways, but railroads that follow these old Indian pathways. Initially, when you get the Erie Canal in play, people in Connecticut, because obviously we don't have strong enough trains, or maybe we don't even have trains to do trips across railroads or even think about railroads, we said, well, what if we make canals? And that will be our transportation in this moment in time. We're talking Erie Canal, so probably the 1820s. So what was really interesting and important to those in that time period is because when they created the Erie Canal, you know, the shipping rates completely dropped. I mean, within 10 years of the Erie Canal's completion, we went from like $90 to $125 down to $4 a ton. So that's why in Connecticut, people kind of looked up, what if we could do that? So in Connecticut itself, we had six canals planned. Really and truly, only the Farmington came into play and ultimately failed. But all of these canals were formed along Indian pathways that you can clearly see on this 1625 map. So I think from there, that's when the railroad comes into play. And where we live up here in the northwest corner, you know, we have a look at the earliest of the railroads that follow the Housatonic River, and obviously there's a lot of Indian pathways along that stretch of river. So they charter it wasn't the Housatonic then, it was the Housatonic, which is obviously an Indian word, in 1836. And by 1837, they're getting the funding that they need. And then we have a railroad from, you know, the start of the Housatonic down in the Stratford, New Haven area, all the way up here to, you know, obviously through all the towns up here from Kent, Cornwall, you know, Sharon, Salisbury, North Canaan. So the Iron Trail is all based off of the old Indian trails. And it's really an interesting look at, you know, that basically that transportation growth. And any railroad you see in the present day can easily be matched up with the Indian pathways. And the reason why is because the pathways always followed the easiest path through the, you know, topography of the land. So just like water flows to the easiest. You know, obviously the Indians weren't blasting through stone or boulders, and later we did that. So by following them, you're following the easiest path. And I think that's what really stood out to me as important. So this was, a progression, from pathways to bridle paths to ox carts to turnpikes to modern highways and railroads. And it's really intriguing that this was all influenced by the Native American Indians. And I think that it's an important thing to, recognize and discuss, because they, if you look back, Indians are now, because we're able to check on DNA and things of that nature, you're seeing reports come out. There was just one out in early April about Blackfoot Indian DNA dating back 18,000 years. I know a lot of people that do archaeology, and they're digging, and they've been finding, proof that Indians were here, Native Americans, indigenous people were here 10,000, 12,000 years. And to put that into context, we've been in Connecticut for less than 400 years. I think the oldest town is Windsor, and that would be 391 years. So it's amazing the role, but it makes a lot of sense because the Native Americans here really lived with the land, and they did the right things with the land. And so I hope that you guys will take my advice and Google search Yukon plus magic and see this map. And, it's really even better than the pathways and roadways is to see all the different types of Indian tribes that were here, and then the ties to, the Quinnipiacs, for instance. Now we have Quinnipiac University. That it's just interesting to see where the tribes were in all your different areas, and then, look where you live, and you'll see where there were villages or camps or, what have you. I mean, Kent's on the map, Sharon's on the map, Hotchkiss is on the map, and there's all these great stories that come from just a little bit of research, and that's really all it took for me to kind of take it down that rabbit hole and try to search for more. And like I said, this started in 2008. I've given a presentation on this in three different states since that time period, and many other people have. It's a really interesting topic, and if you have the time and you want to learn more about their culture, right over in Washington, Connecticut, you have the Institute for American Indian Studies, and they do a fantastic job there. Their museum is great. They have summer programs for kids. It's inside, outside museum, and they give a lot of great talks too. So I hope you've enjoyed this one, and like I said, this is one of my favorite historical finds, and the influence of American Indian pathways and what they had on not only Connecticut transportations, but also our settlements. So thank you for listening. Thank you for being here this week. And as we've noted in all episodes, we have an email account. So if you write to stories at robinhoodradio.com, you can tell us what you think and what you want to know more about, and we'll circle back. So until next time, be well and always do right. This will gratify some people and astonish the rest. Enjoy your week.
Old Stories, New Information with Brent Colley is produced at the studios of WHDD 91.9 FM, robinhoodradio.com, Sharon, Connecticut.